This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After more than a decade as mayor of Orlando, what's next for Buddy Dyer? He's running for re-election, saying he wants to continue the work he's done to help bring Sunrail to fruition, develop the Performing Arts Centre, and continue affordable housing projects. But even though the mayor is a fan of expanding the city's transit options, you won't see him on an electric scooter once those arrive in the City Beautiful. I spoke to Dyer at his campaign office in downtown Orlando.
Well, Mayor Dyer, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
So what is it that keeps you interested in this and makes you want to come back for more?
You know, I get up excited every single day. This is such a dynamic time in the history of our city. And I tell other mayors that, you know, a lot of cities, their history is already made and they're, you know, like a big battleship that you can't turn. But we're making our history now and we're just becoming what we're really going to be. So it's an exciting time to be part of it.
It does present some challenges though, right? I mean, a city as dynamic as Orlando, because you have a lot of immigration or in-migration into the city, that poses some challenges. I mean, affordable housing is one challenge. I wonder if you could sort of lay out what your concerns might be there and how you plan to tackle that particular issue.
Sure. Well, one thing is we have the good challenges. They're because of growth. We're getting 1,500 new residents every single week in Central Florida. And then we also lead the country in job creation. So it does tax our infrastructure to have that type of growth. So planning how to manage the growth and do it in a smart manner is important. On the affordable housing issue, certainly that presents challenges, and it's exacerbated by the fact that we're a low-wage economy, or large part of a low-wage economy, and city's taking a leadership role there, and we're going to increase our wages for our employees to $15 an hour over the course of the next budget, next contract. And then you have the people, the growth part of it, and then you have the fact that after the recession, builders wanted to build more expensive housing than they did the moderate or lower income housing. So what the city has done is taken a leadership role there as well. We've incentivized 14 different projects that are either 100% affordable or some portion affordable, and they're spread throughout the city, but we can't do it alone. We're, you know, 300,000 of the roughly 3 million people here, so we need the other governments to step up as well.
And those projects are expensive, they take time to complete, and there's always a big waiting list, right? I mean, people need affordable housing, and that means they're knocking at the door saying, I need this now. So how do you incentivize or motivate others to get involved, whether it's other governments, people in the private sector? What's the solution?
Well, the Orange County Task Force that Mayor Deming's appointed is using a lot of the things that we put into play, or that's what the recommendations are going to be. So we changed a lot of our land use and zoning regs so that you could build more efficiently. So smaller units, smaller apartment buildings, units of less than eight. We have encouraged granny flats or ancillary structures on lots. So if we would encourage them to take up some of the measures that we have as well.
But there are folks who say, you know, basically we don't want this in our neighborhood too. I mean, there are people who say we want to preserve the character, and there is a lot of character in downtown Orlando. So how do you balance those two competing interests?
Well, you know, I've seen that in other communities. We've been pretty successful in building community consensus behind the projects that we've done. And what we've really had good success in is we've taken down old dilapidated projects, and what we're putting in its place is new, and they're a great product that's going in, so the neighbors are happy.
What do you do with folks who you might have to move out of a housing complex for a while you put something new in place? Like, what's the solution there or the strategy there?
Well, you try to find them new housing before you do that. Most of the cases that we've had, the structures have been boarded up and unoccupied.
Mm-hmm. Now, housing is one of the themes that your opponents are also talking about, and a couple other things that, you know, goals that I think you all share in common is transportation, improving transportation, and just overall quality of life. Let's talk about transportation for a moment. How far along do you think Orlando is in terms of mass transit and transit options, transportation options for people who live here?
So one of the things that I'm proud of that I was able to get done was Sunrail. It's operational both the north phase and the south phase. The next thing we need to do is take it to the airport. And when we do that, we'll go to seven-day service and more frequent service. So it's successful now, but it'll be much more successful when we can get to 7 days a week.
So wait, let me just ask about that then. You're saying that because if you have that airport link, you're going to have more passengers, therefore you can sustain that 7-day a week service?
No, you'll still have to subsidize it, but I think it's going to be important that we all support the sales tax initiative that Mayor Demings is going to bring to the ballot in November 2020, and I'll go on record as saying I am a supporter of that, but that's where money will come to be able to expand that service. Now, understand that we've invested, close to $10 billion in transportation infrastructure over the last several years, everything from the Missing Link, the Wekiva Parkway, I-4, the Southern Terminal, SunRail expansion, but we've got great momentum right now, but the one thing that could stop our momentum is if we don't keep up with the transportation infrastructure.
And you're talking about roads as well as mass transit?
All of it, but we need to have a focus on mass transit because we're behind that curve, and we've been, through our history, a one-person, one-car type of society in Central Florida, so we've got to make it easier for people to use mass transportation, so increase the number of buses that Lynx has and the frequency there, expand SunRail. There could be other modes of transportation as well. Florida East Coast, or Virgin, now it's called Virgin, mm-hmm. is going to come from Miami to Orlando International in a couple of years and maybe expand on to Tampa as well. So there's another mode of mass transportation.
That terminal at the airport is ready and waiting for trains, right? And it's kind of sitting there anticipating that rail link in, and it looks like Virgin Trains, or what used to be Brightline, will be the first in there. But, I mean, thinking about SunRail, just how far off into the future is that? And do you think that's something that could be, that link could be achieved in your next term as mayor, or even after that if you decided to run again?
I think that's possible. It's going to be highly dependent on whether we pass that sales tax initiative. The right-of-way is there because we would go along the OUC coal line. City owns OUC, so we can provide that right-of-way as part of it, so we don't have that step that we have to take. And there's enough right-of-way to double-track it all the way in through the airport. So if we have the funding, I think we could get started on it.
Mm-hmm. And just in terms of SunRail in general, I mean, the Florida Department of Transportation will turn that over to the cities and counties, you know, in a year or two. Do you have some nerves or some butterflies in your stomach about how we're going to keep this thing funded and keep it going once that happens?
Well, the city share of it's about $10 million a year. And again, if we pass the sales tax initiative, that can be used for operational funds. So I'm sure that we can do that out of the sales tax revenue. If we don't have the sales tax revenue, we've set aside money for our part of it.
A couple of other counties tried to pass something similar to what Mayor Demings proposed. They didn't succeed. Does that worry you at all?
Certainly, it worries me a little bit. However, some other counties were successful. So Osceola was not, but Hillsborough, which had been trying to pass an initiative for quite some time, passed it during the last general election. Mm-hmm. The Osceola County was a standalone single-issue election that came at a bad time. There were some other issues out there that led people not to trust what was going on with the county commission, so hopefully we won't have that.
So you're saying the 2020 election should give a bit of a tailwind to this?
I think so, because there'll be substantial turnout. It's a presidential election, so should be good turnout.
So your State of the City address, you addressed some pretty big and lofty goals. You talked about wanting the city to be future-ready by embracing new technology like 5G and some ambitious plans to be 100% renewable energy for municipal buildings by 2030, zero waste by 2040, and 100% renewable energy citywide by 2050. So how are you going to get there?
You know, I think all of those goals are achievable. When I first became mayor, Kathy Waltz was the publisher of the newspaper, and she said that she thought Orlando had a little bit of an inferiority complex, but a number of years later, when we'd been successful on Medical City and other things, she said that she'd changed her mind and that Orlando and its citizens could do and achieve anything they set their mind to do. And those are big, bold goals, but if we set our mind to doing it, we can do it. Mm-hmm. OUC is looking at how they can retire the Stanton 1 and Stanton 2 over the course of time. So that 2050 goal is certainly achievable. And we just had some really cool stuff on the last agenda with battery technology that they're doing some research on. So to reach that goal, there has to be improved battery storage technology to come into play, but I think that'll happen.
Is it solar? I mean, talking about energy, is it solar power?
Largely solar. I mean, we don't have some of the other types, geothermal, or, you know, maybe we can do wind, but in Florida, it's largely got to be solar. Mm-hmm. On the 5G, I think we have to be one of the cities that's future ready in that regard, because I believe that there will be cities that are left behind if they don't adopt or facilitate, I guess would be a better word, 5G, and that's going to take a while to get into place, and there's still things we have to figure out. But one of the things we did was set up a permitting process where a company could come in and say, here's the 4, 5, 6 ways that we would make the application, and then they can just say, okay, we're going to use application C at this location, and it will improve the permitting time.
5G, though, there are some wrinkles to be ironed out. I mean, one thing which is particularly pertinent for people in Florida is concerns that implementing 5G could have an impact on the accuracy of weather forecasting, and particularly for hurricanes. Is that something you're thinking about? Like, are we rushing down this road too quickly?
I don't think we're rushing down the road too quickly, but I think there are things we're going to learn as it's implemented. I'm not an expert in that general area, but I do want to make it possible that make sure that we're one of the early cities using the technology.
And just thinking about that too, I mean, further down the track, if you want to make Orlando future ready, you have to think about things like climate change and what that might do to the coastline, the kind of city that Orlando may be in 20, 30, even, you know, 40 or 50 years out, maybe more people moving to the center of Florida than the coast.
There's certainly going to be more migration. So 1,500 residents a week, like we were talking about, it might be more than that in the future. So we need to continue to anticipate that we're going to grow, and that we're going to grow a more diverse population. We're already a pretty diverse city, and I think now 20% of the people that live in Orlando are international, mm-hmm. Weren't born in the U.S. So I think we have to anticipate that we're going to continue to have a more diverse population and larger population.
What about diversity of employment?
We're always looking to add high-wage, high-value jobs. We've been very good at creating industry clusters. Creative Village is just the latest, but certainly Medical City is an example of that. Our modeling, simulation, and training out at Research Park is an example of that. So we want to get into, another area would be green jobs. So we want to be in line for autonomous, be a center for autonomous vehicles. So a lot of good stuff that when you have people coming here and wanting to invest their money, you can create those types of jobs.
Right. I mean, it seems like there's kind of two stratas to the economy here, right? There are the high-wage jobs you're talking about, and then there are a lot of people who move here to work in the service industry, to, you know, work in the theme parks, the hotel industry. How do you make sure that you have the resources so that those folks don't have to work 2 or 3 jobs just to get by?
Well, increasing wages is certainly one thing. Having a enough housing stock. We don't have enough housing, not just at the affordable end, but it drives rents up when the law of supply and demand is working and the demand is higher than the supply. So simply increasing housing stock so that the rents stabilize is a way to help. And then mobility is another issue. If you don't have to own a car, because we've got a great transportation system that allows you options, even using scooters, for instance.
Are you going to get on one of these scooters when they come to town?
I don't think so. I initially wasn't very receptive to the scooters, but there's been a lot of interest in them, and the bike share companies are replacing their bikes with scooters in a lot of places, and it indicated that they were going to do it here. And it's, you know, it's a costs 5 times more to buy one of those bikes than it does the scooter. So mm-hmm. we're going to do a pilot. We're going to allow 5 companies with 200 scooters each for a year, and we'll see how that goes.
When does that start?
It'll start towards the end of the year, first of the year probably.
I mean, when you go to a city like Washington, D.C., for example, where they've had scooters for a little while, you do see people zipping around on them, but you'd see some of the challenges too, right? Like, how do you regulate where they ride the scooters? What about where they pile up? And some of the same issues that you get with, you know, bike share too. How do you tackle that challenge?
So we'll have some no-fly zones like Lake Eola Park. You won't be able to leave or be able to pick them up in certain residential neighborhoods. I guess you can drop them there, and they got to pick them up at night and replace them back in the areas that they should be in. We'll regulate the speed. I think I can't remember if we're going to do 10 miles or 12 miles an hour. But my concern is we have a lot of brick streets.
Sure, yeah.
And the wheels are smaller on the scooters than they are on bikes. And, you know, the accident rate with those things, especially for first-time users, is pretty high. Mm-hmm. They're usually a head injury involved. So I just have concerns about it, and that's why we're doing it as a pilot.
Does it help, though, solve some of the last mile issues you might have with something like SunRail, where you've got a rail system going up the spine of Orlando, but then you've got to get out to the, you know, the further flung reaches of the city, whether it's Winter Park or Altamont Springs or wherever?
It absolutely helps. The bikes help. Rideshare companies help. Scooters will certainly present that option for people that want to use them.
The opioid crisis is another issue that affects obviously not just Orlando, but the entire state of Florida, and there have been various initiatives to try and get a grip on it. What are you going to be doing to kind of help move that ball along in terms of getting people the help they need?
It certainly has to be an awareness issue, and to try to do away with the stigma of somebody being an opioid user, and getting people to look for help and understand that we want to give them help. We have the NOCS, now all the OFD and OPD have that available. We're leaving some behind as well, like the sheriff's office is doing. But I think awareness is really important.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to technology. One of the things that the city has been trialing out, at least the police, has been the use of surveillance technology, the camera systems. There's been some pushback from folks in the community who say, there are some concerns there, right? I mean, what about privacy? How involved are you going to be as mayor and sort of shepherding through systems like that if the police decide to take it further?
Well, we've got cameras everywhere. So
sure.
What you're talking about is facial recognition.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. So we did that pilot program. It wasn't successful. So, but we're always looking for uses of technology, and facial recognition isn't really new. You go to the airport, and they're using it now to board airplanes and to come through customs and stuff. So I didn't see some of the concerns, but we were only going to use it and would only use it for crime prevention.
Right. But, I mean, I guess the concern is, like, how does the data get stored? What kind of security is there, and how does it get shared? So some of those issues, which I guess kind of go beyond the bounds of the city, right?
Yeah, they would. And maybe you're talking about also we're in some of those databases that can read license plates and locate vehicles is mm-hmm. another one, and that's a shared database that we bought into.
Do you have a few goals that we haven't talked about yet that you want to get done for this next term if you're successful in this election campaign?
Yeah, there's absolutely a lot of things that I would like to continue. The growth of SunRail and getting it to the airport is one. The growth of Creative Village, we've got phase one in. EA's going to be there in 2 years. Finishing the Performing Arts Center is certainly another goal that we have. And then working on the affordable housing and homeless issues are things that I've been devoting quite a bit of my time on right now.
And a lot of them are tied up together. I mean, moving EA to the Creative Village is a big deal, but it also kind of accelerates the change of that particular part of the city, right? And there are concerns from longtime residents of Paramore, like, what is going to happen to my neighborhood?
Only good positive things. I like to think of a 2-year-old now in Paramore that can go to the ACE school in the preschool program, go into pre-K, kindergarten, go through 8th grade, go to Jones, come back and go to Valencia, either accelerated training or 4-year degree, then go to Florida A&M, get a law degree, and work right in downtown Orlando.
But there's got to be a way to make sure they don't get priced out of that community, right?
Well, and we've done some of that with the housing trust fund that the Central Florida Foundation put together, purchased 82 of the homes that were owned by some not so scrupulous landlords, let's just say. City's invested money to help with the rehab, and OUC is also helping with weatherizing them to make them more energy efficient, because that's another part of the affordable housing issue also is how much your utilities are. And if you're living in substandard housing, that your air conditioning bill is twice what it should be, that eats into your paycheck as well.
One of the things I've asked you about in the past is, you know, interest you might have in that role with the University of Central Florida. I'm just wondering if that kind of crosses your mind. Are you fully committed to the position of Mayor of Orlando, or do you sometimes think about University of Central Florida and sort of think, I wonder if this could be the place for me?
No, I made that decision last time around. So I love being mayor of Orlando. I love serving the people. I'm more energized today than when I ran in 2003. And actually, I've got a lot more experience at the job than I did in 2003.
Mayor Buddy Dyer, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And we'll bring you conversations with Dyer's opponents in the mayoral race on Intersection. Next week, City Commissioner Sam Ings lays out the case for why he should be the next mayor of Orlando. Still to come, Markeith Lloyd awaits sentencing after being found guilty of the murder of Sade Dixon. We'll talk to Orlando Sentinel Courts reporter Monavette Cordero about what's next for Lloyd. He's yet to stand trial for the murder of police officer Deborah Clayton. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Markeith Lloyd has been found guilty for the murder of Sade Dixon. Dixon was pregnant when she was killed by Lloyd in 2016. Weeks later, a massive manhunt was launched after Lloyd allegedly killed police officer Deborah Clayton in a Walmart parking lot. Lloyd is yet to stand trial for the murder of Lieutenant Clayton. Orlando Sentinel Courts reporter Monavette Cordero has been covering the first murder trial and joins us now. Thank you so much, Monavette.
Thanks for having me.
So, what was the response from the family of Sade Dixon to the verdict last night?
The family of Sade Dixon hugged each other after the verdict. Lloyd was also found guilty of attempting to murder three of Dixon's family members during the shooting, including her mother, Stephanie Dixon Daniels. And so her mom was crying, and she later told reporters she was ecstatic with the jury's decision and that they were able to see the truth through the defense's smokescreen. Lloyd had no visible reaction, and neither did his family.
Mm-hmm. Now, defense lawyer Terrence Lenemon had highlighted Lloyd's distrust of police while he was making his argument in this case. Why was that important?
Lloyd's defense had argued his mistrust of police as someone who was arrested wrongly and growing up as a black man led him to absconding from police instead of turning himself in. His attorney said Lloyd's niece tried to get detectives and the press to talk about how Dixon had pulled a gun on him before he shot her, but they wouldn't, and that convinced him that police wanted to kill him. The defense was trying to show Lloyd didn't shoot Orlando Police Lieutenant Deborah Clayton because he felt guilty over Dixon's killing, but because he distrusted police.
I'm wondering, though, because, you know, that's a separate trial, how was the defense in this case, how was Terrence Lenemon able to sort of bring that up and use that in this trial?
Right. Well, in this trial, jurors weren't allowed to know that Deborah Clayton had died, just that she had been shot. And the purpose of that was to allow the prosecution to present consciousness of guilt because he, you know, had shot Lieutenant Clayton. That meant that he, you know, felt guilty or didn't want to turn himself in because of the Dixon killing.
But it seems like it could be a little bit of a slippery slope there if they're trying to really separate these two cases.
Yeah, it was definitely hard for them, and that came up a lot during the trial. Obviously, you know, telling jurors, you know, they're not to consider anything during the Clayton shooting, just the fact that there was a shooting between Clayton and Lloyd. But they didn't know about Clayton's death, and they could, again, only consider that the same gun was used in both. So it was definitely difficult during the trial to make sure jurors knew the difference and to know that they couldn't consider any of that.
Aside from Lloyd's distrust of police, what else did defense lawyer Terrence Lenemon focus on in his argument to try and persuade the jury of Lloyd's innocence in this case?
So a large part of the defense argument was putting Markeith Lloyd on the stand and letting him be heard. That's been an issue for Lloyd since before his arrest, and it's continued throughout his trial. Lloyd told jurors about how his main concern was having a baby with Dixon and how he was planning to stay with her for 6 months so she couldn't get an abortion within that time. He told jurors about grabbing her by the neck one time and throwing her down, and about how he broke up with her because she lied to him about eating meat and smoking weed while pregnant, and later confessed to her having been unfaithful. So, I mean, according to him, the reason he went to Dixon's house after they broke up was to prevent her from having an abortion. And so the defense thought that, I guess, this honesty about him defending himself during the actual shooting, because he claimed that Dixon's brother, Ronald Stewart, had attacked him. I think they thought that this was going to help them with the jury, but prosecutors used all this, though, as evidence that Lloyd was controlling and that he was determined to kill Dixon because she wasn't doing what he wanted. Prosecutors also focused on the 8 times that Lloyd shot Dixon and the fact that he had to pull the trigger 8 times as a sign of premeditation. Again, like, Lloyd is claiming that he shot Dixon and her brother in self-defense after Stewart attacked him, even though prosecutors said that he shot the siblings as they were walking back into the house. So when Assistant State Attorney Rick Ridgway asked Lloyd, when he was on the witness stand, to explain how a bullet fragment could be in the spot where Lloyd shot Stewart if he wasn't firing down, he wasn't able to answer.
I'm wondering, too, if you could shed some light on what we heard from Lloyd after the main part of the trial, because he had some complaints about the defense presented by his own attorney. What did he tell the judge?
Lloyd told Circuit Judge Leticia Marquez he wanted some additional blood testing done, as well as for his attorneys to explain more the confrontation between him and Stewart during closing arguments. Lloyd was shaking his head through much of the prosecution's closing argument, so I think he just wanted his attorneys to really hammer it in, which I would argue they did. Defense attorney Terrence Lenneman at one point accused Dixon's family of making stuff up during their testimonies because they wanted Lloyd to get the death penalty. So I think he argued it as well as he could. He really did a good job of saying all the things that Lloyd had gone over during his testimony.
There was a very big jury pool to select from in this case, over fears they wouldn't be able to find an impartial jury. And jury selection was expected to take many weeks, but in the end, it seemed like it wrapped up pretty quickly. Can you walk us back and tell us what happened there?
The judge was able to find 12 jurors and 4 alternates within about 2 weeks, which was really surprising, since initially they worried it would take hundreds of more jurors. Potential jurors were questioned in panels and individually on their media exposure, stance on the death penalty, hardship, and whether, you know, they could be sequestered in a hotel for weeks. And jury selection moved a bit more quickly, in part because Lloyd's defense attorney decided not to question jurors a second time.
Mm-hmm. And then the trial itself, as you said, moved pretty quickly. Were you and the other sort of media contingent a bit surprised about the pace of things once they got that jury impaneled?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's taken us almost 3 years to get to this point, from the night Lloyd is accused of gunning down his pregnant ex-girlfriend. And because this trial just focused on Dixon's killing, it was pretty straightforward, and prosecutors did not have to bring in a ton of witnesses or experts. It'll be interesting, definitely, to see how long the trial for Clayton's killing takes.
Mm-hmm. And that's set for next year. Do we know if he will have the same attorney for the second trial?
Yes. The defense attorneys for Lloyd's team, Terrence Lenneman and Ted Marrero, have been working on both these trials at the same time, and that was Lloyd's and the attorney's complaints before the Dixon trial started, was that they've been working on both of these at the same time. They've had to prepare not only their defense to the trial itself, but also to, you know, the potential death penalty argument. So it's been a lot of work for this team of attorneys.
Mm-hmm. And what's the next step? I guess we go to sentencing. So what can you tell us about when that'll happen?
The jury of 12 will have to decide unanimously if a judge should sentence Lloyd to life in prison or the death penalty. This will happen during the sentencing phase of the trial, which starts on Monday.
Okay, so the things aren't over yet for this particular jury?
No. They're still sequestered at the hotel. The two remaining alternates that are still in the panel are also sequestered at the hotel, and they will be back on Monday.
Monavet, I'm wondering if this trial has given you some kind of sense of what the defense may be for the trial and the death of Lieutenant Clayton next year.
Lloyd's attorneys will, I think, again, focus on this longstanding distrust of police they say Lloyd had, where he believed police wanted to kill him, as well as an argument of self-defense by trying to prove Clayton shot at Lloyd first before he turned the gun on her. And that was part of some of the arguments that they made. They brought in an expert on this bullet fragment that was collected outside of the Walmart, a little bit further away from the crime scene, and bringing in this expert to say that this evidence, you know, was not collected in a proper way by police, and that was evidence of, you know, the prosecution and police hiding this from the jury, which the prosecution denied.
Well, Bonavit Cordero is the Orlando Sentinel Courts reporter. She's been covering the Markeith Lloyd murder trial. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, the legacy of longtime WMFE political commentator and former Congressman Lou Fry. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Here at WMFE, we're mourning the death of Lou Fry. The longtime Republican political analyst and former congressman passed away this week at the age of 85. For 20 years, Fry was a fixture on the airwaves at WMFE, discussing local and national politics with Democratic political analyst Dick Batchelor. We're going to hear from Batchelor in a moment, but first here's Charlie Gray, attorney with Gray Robinson. He helped Fry get elected to Congress in the late 60s.
I'm very proud to have had him as a friend all these years, and respect his work tremendously. My thoughts and prayers and love go out to his family, who are wonderful, wonderful people.
Former Intersection host Mark Simpson, now Director of News and Public Affairs with Maine Public Broadcasting, says he enjoyed the historical and political insights in his conversations with Lou Fry.
Understanding the history behind the Kennedy Space Center and getting the shuttle program launched, it was always fascinating to hear that context. And the thing that I loved about it the most was his ability to be able to thread historical events into present-day context and understand why they still held meaning and relevance.
And Fry helped usher in the shuttle program on the Space Coast. Here's former Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson.
Well, he was certainly one of the major contributors to it. Anyone who represents East Central Florida and works at it hard and finds out and does their homework so that you can be an advocate for the space program. And he was in the right place at the right time to do that. As importantly, the nation had spent just a lot of money getting to the moon to beat the Russians. And then the layoffs occurred, 25,000 people starting to be laid off at the Kennedy Space Center at the end of Apollo. And all of the economic deprivation, almost like a recession at the time. And then coming back out of that with the new technology, this fantastic flying machine called the Space Shuttle.
That's former U.S. Senator Bill Nelson reflecting on Lou Fry's legacy. Intersection producer Brendan Byrne sat down with Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres to talk more about the impact Fry had on political and civic life in Florida.
Well, joining us to talk about Lou Fry's career as both a congressman and a commentator here on WMFE is longtime Democratic commentator Dick Batchelor. Dick, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And Republican commentator Frank Torres. Frank, thank you.
Thank you.
Dick, take us back. When was the first time you met Lou Fry?
Oh, many years ago. I did not meet him, but in passing, I should say, in 1968, at the age of 32, he got elected to Congress. And I remember because he always had his jacket over his shoulder. That was kind of the thing. And probably one of the first politicians ever to go door-to-door. I mean, seriously, go to door-to-door. Because keep in mind, in 1968, there weren't a lot of Republicans in the congressional delegation in Florida. Democrats run everything in Tallahassee throughout the state. So he kind of set his mark then as kind of being the people's choice, if I could use that term, and really made it a granular politics, one-on-one, door-to-door. And but, you know, he also, after elected to Congress, he conducted himself that way, too. He was always accessible and built a reputation as, well, we know now, as a real, a genuine public servant and really a statesman, something that we're sorely lacking.
Frank Torres, is that his legacy, the constituents politician?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he represents a way of leading that a lot of people are hungry for today. A policymaker who listens and absorbs what's being said from the constituents and from both sides of the conversation. And I think that's what people – that's what helped him succeed in government, and what and one of the main reasons that we're admiring him right now.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, from my time working with both you and Lou Fry, mm-hmm. the conversations had always been civil, educational. How did your relationship develop on air with Lou Fry?
Well, it's interesting because I knew Lou having been in politics too, but getting to know him on the air and getting to know him personally and what an honorable person he was. And you're right, it was civil exchange. We always try to do things analytical. What's driving this decision? Not that it's right or wrong necessarily, or you're right and I'm wrong necessarily. But that was really who I got to know him as, just somebody who's well-informed, and really just very, very appropriate in his approach to things, political. He wasn't there to say, let's debate, you're right and I'm wrong. He was there to say, let's have an informed conversation. Mm-hmm. How about that for a new change, an informed conversation? So it was always a delight. We never had an argument, as you know, on the air. And we had never had an argument off the air. But I just really, we're all going to miss him greatly. We obviously, on behalf of all of us, we certainly send our sympathies to the mm-hmm. lovely family. But this community, when they get a chance to review his mark on this community, one I have to tell you quickly because it's one of my favorite stories. We used to have a McCoy Air Base here, Air Force Base. It closed down, and when Lou Fry was a congressman, he got the federal government to sell that land, which is now the Orlando International Airport, to the city of Orlando for $1.
$1?
And Carl Langford was mayor at the time, and we passed the legislation locally. I was in the legislature creating the airport authority. Way back, you know, that had to be like 1975 or so. But keep in mind, but obviously he represented the space industry, so he was a big pro NASA fan, cared about the employees at NASA and how they were being treated. And then lastly, I'll make another point too, which Frank can certainly relate to. He had the Lou Fry Institute. Mm-hmm. So his legacy, his history, his passion to get young people involved in the process in an informed way, you know, not yelling and screaming, but in an informed way, the Lou Fry Institute taught teachers how to teach civics. And it was he and Bob Graham, a Democrat, who got the Republican legislature to pass legislation to require civics in the classroom again. So his legend continues, and it will certainly carry on because of the young people he's impacted, the young people he's impacted through mm-hmm. the Lou Fry Institute.
Frank Torres, as Dick Batchelor mentioned, you know, his program on civics education was with Bob Graham, a Democrat. His efforts to get NASA's space shuttle program at the Kennedy Space Center was in part by reaching across the aisle and working with Democrats for that. Is that Lou Fry's legacy as someone who was able to build that bridge between parties?
Absolutely. I think that's part of his legacy, in addition to the work at the Institute, which Dick just laid out. The younger generation, you know, aspiring members or younger members that want to get into government, that want to get into politics, they would listen to Lou Fry. He was invited to meetings for groups with much younger audiences just to hear what he had to say, and almost with an urgency that his type of wisdom in the field was kind of disappearing. A lot of politicians will get up there these days and they'll say inflammatory things and they'll say wild things to get a rise. It was rewarding to listen to Lou Fry just because we knew that there were pathways to being successful and helping other people through government by having the conversations and listening to everybody involved. Mm-hmm.
A great contrast would be, and I won't use any names, but they're on the left, and I can say that. The social media, the YouTube generation, the Snapchat generation out right. there, you know, it reminded me of, when I talk about Lou and think about Lou, you have politicians who are satisfied with being well-known for being well-known, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have politicians who want to be known for getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
Lou Fry had his fingerprints on, like I said, the space program. EPA, I mean, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, under Richard Nixon.
Right.
And by the way, I think he In fact, I know he did. He flew, got Richard Nixon to speak at FTU graduation commencement, and flew down to Air Force One with him when no one else wanted to be seen with Richard Nixon at the time. So he had those relationships at the highest level, but he cultivated those relationships to get things done, mm-hmm. not so Lou Fry could be well-known for being simply well-known.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, what do you think Lou Fry would say about our current political climate and how divisive it is and how it's a right versus left, Republicans versus Democrats thing? I mean, how would he react to the news of the day?
He and I talked about it some before he left NPR, left the air here, and he was very disenchanted by it, again, because he comes from another school, and we hope we can revigorate that kind of people who want to be known for getting things done and want to, it's okay to be a statesman, male or female.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very, he was not happy, to put it politely, with the current political environment, because that's not the political environment he grew up in, that he served in, that he got things done in. It's very caustic, acerbic. You know, it used to be you'd have a conversation about, let's have a conversation. This is your opinion, this is my opinion. But now you start with, I don't like you. I don't like your politics. And by the way, the old proverbial, you're yelling so loud I can't hear you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on in politics today. And I think it dismayed Congressman Fry, and certainly did not please him.
Mm-hmm. We were going through some of the archive tape of your conversations with Lou Fry. And this is a piece of tape that we found in 2015. This was before the GOP mm-hmm. primary, before Marco Rubio entered the race. And we were talking about how Lou was worried that this could divide the Republican Party. So let me just go and play a little bit of that.
Jeb Bush versus Marco Rubio, is that ever going to happen in a primary?
No. If it does, the Republicans can go home. You've got to figure it out, and somebody's got to end up being the candidate, and it could be a very well-oiled campaign at that point when mm-hmm. it happens. And I think it's got to happen. Otherwise, if you're having you destroy the Republican Party.
So that was Lou Fry speaking with 90.7's Matthew Petty in 2015. Frank, what do you think he would think of the Republican Party now?
I think that he would still be on that same track of thinking that he's in right now. And as far as the Republican Party right now, give me a delegation of Lou Fry's over most of what we have right now. And I think we'll get a lot more done. So that's really the state of where we're at now, as opposed to the era where he served and was just able to accomplish so much more.
And I'll tell you who he reminds me of a great deal. If I had to compare him to a national figure, it was George Bush, 41.
Mm-hmm.
Same class of people, very knowledgeable, very passionate, but not necessarily in a measured way, but measured in order to get things, compromises done. And, of course, he probably liked to hang out at Kenny Buck Punk 2 with George Bush, 41, but he had this relationship with the entire – he was very close, obviously, to the Bush family, Bush 43, Bush 41,
mm-hmm.
the whole family. So, but I would say if I were going to – maybe a Reagan, but more like of a Bush 41 kind of a style. That's the, mm-hmm. that's the way I see it. Of course, he was very, very proud of being in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about that a lot. And as a Marine, I thanked him for his service. But, wonderful man, wonderful mm-hmm. man.
Dick Batchelor, we know a lot about Lou Fry because he was in public office mm-hmm. for so long and because he was on our airwaves for so long as well. We got to see that side of Lou Fry. But you've been friends with him for decades. Was Lou Fry off the air the same as he was on the air?
I had the pleasure of being entertained by he and his lovely wife and family from time to time, and to me he was just the same. Now, look, Lou, let me not mislead you. As a recovering politician, I would far be for me to mislead you. Lou personally was political too. He loved people. I mean, he liked engaged people. He hosted so many people in his house: former congressmen, current congressmen, women, but he liked it. I mean, I just not to dismay anybody, but he likes politics. He likes the political side of knowing people. So I always found him very personable, in a very engaging. But he liked his politics, which is okay.
Mm-hmm. Frank, when you would run into him, what is your lasting impression of Lou Fry?
You know, most of my time I spent with Lou Fry was when I was beginning my analysis career about 9 years ago. We'd occasionally be on the same segment together with Dick and perhaps somebody else, and he showed me how it's done. He showed me how to intelligently discuss a political issue with your views in a way that not only got your points across, but helped other people understand.
Mm-hmm. We would joke after a taping about Louisms or things that he would say. Dick, do you have any favorite sayings from him or some advice that he gave you or gave to our listeners?
I'm trying to think. There was one that he had with favorite, but I can't remember. The only one thing I do remember about Lou, which was a little weird, I would must have, he wore the ugliest socks. I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Here's a retired naval officer. You know, you'd think he'd be, you know, somewhat squared away, but I bought him some uglier socks, and he wore those.
A good friend, huh?
But he had these isms, but I just cannot think of one at the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. I remember one thing listening to you when I would produce the show is political capital. That was something that you both would always talk about. It was hard to raise and easy to lose.
Right.
And that was kind of the Lou Fry politics of things, right? Dealing with those relationships and building those relationships and you know, getting that political capital to use back on his constituents.
Yeah, we talked a lot about, you know, it's, as you said, or inferred, political currency is very hard
currency,
to earn,
yes.
But
yeah.
It's very easy to lose. So how do you expend it? But obviously he had accumulated political currency. But you know the fascinating thing about Lou, too? His political currency lasted far beyond his years of public service. Even, I mean, whether it's on NPR, on Channel 13, the Lou Fry Institute, he had the political currency still to go and engage the community, you know, because he's, of course, been a congressman. He's run for governor. He's liked, right? And he's got this, I would call it political currency and personal currency. But he used it for the good after he left office. Again, I get the Lou Fry Institute, I keep going back to because he's touched so many people's lives. And then keep in mind the Lou Fry Institute, as I mentioned, they teach teachers how to teach civics. So there are tens of thousands of people they've reached that way. So he used his political currency beyond his years in elective office.
Mm-hmm. And was he ever kind of dismayed by losing elections? You know, he ran for governor, he ran for senator. And didn't win, but that wasn't the end of him politically, was it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm not sure. Having run and won and run and lost, we're always dismayed. But in fact, we used to tease and say, you know, the first time you lost the race, you know, you want to be philosophical, you want to be reflective, and you think about the outcome and go, boy, those voters are stupid.
Frank Torres, you mentioned about having civil discussions, and that's going to be something that you remember Lou by. Do you think that will live on? Will people remember that, and will we continue to think about Lou Fry when we have political conversations with each other, with people that we might not agree with? Do you see that continuing in today's political climate?
Goodness, I hope so. I hope that the work that the Institute is doing and that the people he's been able to teach up to this point in turn keep teaching other people so that kind of political conversation can keep going and that we get above the yelling and the shouting that, you know, we see so much every day. I think as much as we can keep around from Lou Fry's philosophy, the better off we'll be on all levels of government.
And Dick Batchelor, I'll give you the final word. We have discussed his very long and storied legacy here, but what do you want folks to remember about Lou Fry 5, 10, 20 years down the track?
That he's obviously was a very honorable man, that he earned his political currency. He retained it even after he left office and deployed it to do good things for people in this community.
We've been speaking with Dick Batchelor. He is our Democratic political analyst about the life and legacy of former analyst and Congressman Lou Fry. Dick, thank you for speaking with us.
Goodbye, Lou. We miss you.
And Frank Torres, our Republican analyst, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Brendan Byrne with that conversation. You can find more information about Lou Fry on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. And a reminder, we can't make programs like Intersection without your help. Support our silent drive with a gift by calling 1-800-785-2020 or going to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.